Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. My guest today is David White, poet, author, lecturer. David holds a degree in marine zoology and has traveled extensively, including living and working as a naturalist guide in the Galapagos Islands and leading anthropological and natural history expeditions in the Andes, the Amazon, and the Himalaya. He has written 6 books of poetry and 3 best-selling prose books, including his latest, The Three Marriages, Understanding the Essentials of Work, Self, and Relationship. David is one of the few poets to take his perspective out on creativity into the field of organizational development, where he works with many European, American, and international companies. You can find out more about him at www.davidwhite.com. So, David, are you there?
I am indeed.
Welcome to Conversations. It's good to have you here, my friend.
Good to join you.
Your new book, The Three Marriages, talking about work, self, and relationship. Just an extraordinary book. So, David, let's start out talking a little bit about The Three Marriages. What are The Three Marriages, and tell us where you were going with this book.
Well, I suppose I was very interested in the way that people actually imagine their work and imagine themselves. As I've worked as a poet, you know, for over 20 years in the organizational world, all around the world, and many places, of course, and many cultures, everyone's grappling with this phenomenon of work-life balance. And I always felt the very question itself, the very metaphor of balance, intuitively wasn't correct. There was something wrong with the very question. And after I'd given it some thought, and I had a kind of spontaneous moment when I was about to give a talk on a subject which as yet hadn't come to me, and I suddenly overheard myself say at the beginning of the talk, I'd actually like to speak about the three marriages. And once I said that, I realized that that people are engaged in three promises in their life, in a way. They have a promise to a partner, or either in their life or one that lies over the horizon who they'd love to come into their life. And, you know, that imaginative effort to actually bring a partner into your life is almost as powerful a relationship as the one that you're attempting to sustain every day with the person you actually live with. So that's one, that's the marriage, of course, that we normally think of as a marriage. But I often think work itself must be a marriage because of the level of difficulty and dedication that it takes over the years and the levels of responsibility in it. And I often jokingly say you must be married to your work because otherwise why would you have put up with so much over the years? And so it's interesting to think of your vocation as something to which you've made a promise to. And quite often it's a secret promise or a secret vow. Of course, if you just have a job where you're just getting by and just paying the bills, then there's probably not much promise in it. But almost always while you're working away in exile at something like that, you're trying to discover inside yourself what the true unspoken conversation is that you're meant to have with work. And work is a marriage in which you're attempting to become visible in the world, attempting to make a difference, and attempting somehow to give some kind of iconic show of what you are in the world, and a kind of essential, not in a showing off way, but in a way that just demonstrates what you're about, what your whole incarnation is about, I suppose. And then briefly, the third marriage is the most difficult marriage of all, which is the marriage to that tricky, movable frontier called yourself, which, like another person and which, like a work, you're constantly having to get to know again. And you're a different person in your 30s than you were in your 20s. You're a different person in your 50s and in your 60s, and these internal revolutions are occurring whereby you've got to catch up with yourself. You've got to keep the conversation alive in order to keep the marriage with the self alive, in the same way you have to keep a conversation with a living, breathing person. So those are the three marriages: reimagining work, self, and relationship. There's a fourth marriage, which is implicit, which is the marriage of marriages. And for many people, that would be the marriage with God, or just with the great creation, with the largest context they can think of. And that's an integration of the three, I suppose.
I'm remembering back some years ago, before either of us had gray hair, and we were there with the Microsoft people on Whidbey Island. I don't know if you know this, but most of those 12 people quit within 2 years after we did that workshop, and that was the spawning of the Microsoft work-life balance program.
Yes.
But the thing that you're talking about is not that. I mean, they're saying, okay, you can't work 90 hours a week. You can only work 60 hours a week now, and you have to do this. And it's very linear, but there's something about meeting the world in each of these and the expansion of our perception that you speak about. Can you speak to that increase in perception and why that's so important?
Well, first of all, your first reference to the fact, you know, about a number of hours, and I think essentially you can't game the system where you take something away from this marriage in order to give it to the other one. There are times, of course, where you just have to strategize slightly differently, but essentially, you know, if you impoverish one of these marriages, you know, if I say I'm going to give up certain essential aspects of my work in order to reinvigorate my marriage, then there'll actually be less of me there. So if you think about it in a strategic way, you can cut yourself off in places in which that's the very part of you which needs to actually be alive, and in all three marriages. And so I'm looking for a kind of fulcrum at the center of human living, whereby you can live these three marriages out in a much simpler way, so you're not charging around the periphery trying to get everything done all the time, partly because you don't have a centered, grounded sense of what you're about. And so implicit in each of these marriages, but especially the marriage with the self, is a necessary sense of stopping, actually, of moving away from the periphery and always getting back to first principles and the primary conversation. And of course, if you're in a relationship with another person over the years, that's one of the essential things that brings us back to life again as a couple. And I do think in the relationship with the self, too, that each person has to constantly bring themselves back from the dead in each succeeding decade. Maybe they have to bring themselves back from the dead two or three times in every 10 years. Partly because we just get away from ourselves. What we're involved with on the periphery starts to forge an identity that's a mode of amnesia and forgetting about the primary sense of presence and incarnation that makes everything make sense.
I want to pull out a little more of this thing of presence. One of the things that struck me, I can't remember whether it was on, but you said something that really stuck with me there about how our identity changes as we increase our states of perception. What were you saying there?
Well, it's something that I first discovered when I went to the Galapagos Islands in my 20s, and I was given an incredible window of perception in that I was allowed to live in those islands for a couple of years, and where I was able to spend a lot of time in silence and paying attention to animals, birds, plants, and landscapes. And I discovered that, in a sense, my identity wasn't dependent on my inherited beliefs. It was actually dependent on how much attention I was paying to that world. And the fiercer and deeper and wider the attention, the more of me was actually present correspondingly. And a lot of our great contemplative traditions would corroborate this, that the more you open up the chord structure of life inside you, you know, the musical spectrum inside you, the more you can actually perceive out there. And actually, there was a marvelous article in the New York Times not long ago about a man who's been researching lucky people. And he found that, as we all suspect, you do, in fact, make your own luck. And lucky people are people who have a very wide perception of what possibly could happen. And so they're paying attention across a whole horizon. And unlucky people, people who complain about their lives or think terrible things are always happening to them, actually have very narrow modes of perception. And they are constantly looking for one thing, and if it's not that thing, then they're going to be existentially disappointed. So it's interesting to think of luck and also destiny, I suppose, and possibility depending on your willingness to come out from behind yourself and meet this conversational frontier, which is also in each of these three marriages. So come out from behind yourself, and there's a particular kind of vulnerability that's needed in order to pay real attention, in order to listen to another, in order to have your work speak back to you. There's a particular vulnerability if you're looking at your work and you're trying to find out whether you're still involved or not, or whether you're just on automatic, because the answer could come back that you're tired of it, you're fed up of it, and there's nothing more in it for you, and you've got to move on. And that can be a terribly vulnerable moment where you realize all the years that you've been so assiduously building this life have come to a place where you have to give it all away. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that's a magnified dynamic of what occurs in each of the three marriages, actually. And of course, with the marriage with the self, it's a dress rehearsal for the great giving away at the end of your life. And it's interesting to think that many of the disciplines in life that we intuitively praise, you know, and our great contemplative and spiritual traditions praise, are all qualities that you'll need when you're on your deathbed, actually. And our great traditions are constantly saying, you're going to have to give it all away anyway. You're going to have to be generous. You're going to have to step into the unknown, ultimately. So why not start practicing now? Why not get with the program? And, of course, it's not a pessimistic view of the future, because it actually brings the moment alive. Any of us who have lost people, you know, close to us, realize, you know, the poignancy with which just the act of being here is imbued when you've had someone really close to you, especially if you had someone who was incredibly charismatic and alive. I've lost a couple of really good people over the last year or two, and people who were the center of attention and who were had incredible minds and beautiful writers, and you feel as if the world is impoverished, and at the same time that gift is somehow starting to appear inside yourself at the same time in embryonic form. And you're making friends with the person all over again, as if you've met for them for the first time, except you're actually bringing them to life again in the way that you apprentice yourself to the future.
I remember our dear friend who passed away last year, John O'Donohue, used to quote Hegel and say, the shortest thing he ever said was, being here is so much. And what I notice around me often is the increased level of apprehension and fear about the future, which seems to be a stop for people to being present in their own lives. Can you talk about that phenomena and how people can use that to open themselves up to a greater relationship to these three marriages?
Well, I think, for instance, in the credit crunch over the last year or two, we had inflated perceptions of what we actually owned and what it was worth. And it was the general conspiracy of inflated perceptions that made us feel we were so communally wealthy, you could say. And it's interesting, you know, that communal wealth enabled so many alternative things to happen, too. I was just at a green conference over in Europe, and it had a very a much lower enrollment, and you realize that many of the people who are trying to change the mainstream system are actually financially dependent upon it too. So there was there's a sense of restricted horizons in one sense. But one of the things I've felt, and I've worked with a lot of these organizations in the financial world, is that there's a lot of real philosophical ground that you're returned to when you lose this kind of insulation around you, especially financial insulation, and that a lot of the money that we had employed was employed for the future in our pensions or was standing there in the background enabling us to do things in our lives. But also it was acting as a kind of, as I say, as a kind of insulation and an excuse for just being that far away from the real conversation in your life. And one of my perceptions is that in order to live your life and in order to do your work, in order to love your partner, you know, your child, in order to get to know yourself, you actually need very little money. And I should say comparatively little money. And even to do good work, you only need a portion of the money that you have in order to take the next step. And in fact, if you were to use everything you had, you would actually distort what you were about to do. That the amount of money you can actually bring to bear on the next step in your life is actually very, very small. And if you can understand that, you understand that you actually most of the time have enough, and at least to take the next step. And as I say, if you had too much, it can actually distort the central conversation. I remember when I first went full time into the world as a poet, and there was very little in the checkbook or the calendar. And I remember that a friend of mine was threatening to support me and to give me money to help me take this step. And I remember intuitively just keeping away from him for a good few months because I was a young father. I didn't know whether I'd have the willpower to say no if he actually offered it to me. But I also knew that whatever I was to do in the future depended on this, you know, this courageous conversation at the center where I would negotiate it step by step and make it work as a poet in the world. And little did I know that I would be involved so much with vocation and courageous conversations in vocation many years later. And it would be a great pity these days if people asked me, you know, well, how do I take a courageous step in my work? And I said, well, you wait for a very rich person to come along and drop you, you know, $30,000 or $40,000.
Well, this
in order to take the next step. So
this whole thing about money, when I, you know, look at where people are stuck often, it's that it's an excuse for not taking a risk, or perhaps what you would call the courageous conversation. Maybe you could talk a little more about that courageous conversation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose money is a currency of help in a way. And there's all kinds of invisible help in the world that doesn't take that form. It takes, it moves in other currents in a way. And so if, you know, you've narrowed your understanding of what you can do to kind of monetary gamesmanship, now you always need some of that particular form of currency. Then you stop looking for all the invisible help that's in other people out there or in circumstances or in events. And you stop looking to that wide horizon from which you can get a helping hand in one way or another, or in which you can see the center of the pattern. You know, you have a wide enough vision that you can understand more of the whole pattern and therefore put yourself at the center of it. And of course, that's what a good entrepreneur does, but a good artist does that. You know, Yeats did that at the center in Ireland in the 1890s through to the 1930s. He saw the whole pattern of independence for the Irish nation. But he also saw that it needed a new kind of imagination, that it wasn't just a strategic passageway they were going to be taking. They needed to actually re-understand who they were and get back to a more grounded Irish conversation, and not one that was predicated on being the victim or the conquered. And of course, that's very hard to move out from. So yes, I'd say money's a great help, but it's just one form of help. And earn a bit of money, but also earn a few other helping hands out in the world by engaging, you know.
My banker grandfather used to say, "Dirty stuff, I wish I had a barrel of it."
That's right. Yeah.
This seems very related, though. This conversation, this courageous conversation, seems to be related to what you've started to call a core conversation, what I would call a natural genius, finding what we were made for, what we're here for.
Yeah.
That's such, you know, so many people have sold out to their job, I can't do that, or they haven't even begun to see what their true calling is. Can you speak to that core conversation and how we can sidle up to it and let it emerge more profoundly?
Yes. Well, of course, there are a lot of people working in the world in order to help other people. I mean, I'm continually in taxis in strange cities around the States and the world, but especially in the States, the taxi drivers are often the first generation who've come in. They don't speak English very well. You often find that they're working all the hours God sends so that their child can go off to college, you know, or go to school, or, and you realize that they're sacrificing their life for their children. And if you have enough of imagination about it, you know, and you understand what you're doing when you're driving around all those hours, then that can be a remarkable work. It's when you're just carrying it resentfully, when you're, you know, working for Boeing and you're just doing it because you've got the kids in the school, you've got the holiday home, you've got the second or third car and all this, and you're just trying to keep it all those plates spinning, that you fall into this awful, stultifying amnesia where you feel helpless and you feel besieged and you need to somehow escape, you know. Except the real escape, you know, the real break for freedom, we should say, is through having those conversations, you know, talking with your partner about how you're living and how much of it is done just through rote, and how much of the stuff do they really need, talking with your kids about simplifying, talking with yourself, you know, and imagining what it would be like to actually simplify, radically simplify, in order to actually give yourself sense of spaciousness, and to start to look for the door, you know, out of the room in which you feel trapped. So once you've done that, you almost always come back to this question about what your central conversation is in life. And you mentioned this word genius, which is really a marvelous way of understanding incarnation, because in the ancient world, you know, in the Latin world, the word genius didn't mean a Mozart or a Madame Curie. It was actually used in a geographical sense to describe a place and the spirit of a place. So if you came along a beautiful Roman road in northern Italy and you came across a bridge across a stream with a pool behind it and a willow over that pool, there'd be said to be a living spirit there that was the genius of the place. And you could go to a lot of other bridges and pools and willows, but it wouldn't have the genius of that place, because it's made up of the meeting, you know, the climate in that area, the particular trees that are there, the water, the landscape around. And so it's interesting to think of human incarnation in the same way, that you as an individual are made up of all of these elements that meet in space and time. All of the DNA and inherited characteristics of your ancestors, you know, wherever they came from Ireland or Germany or Africa, you know. And they all meet in you in this kind of cross current. Not only that, but you've got the landscape of your birth, literally. Where were you born? Were you born in the plains? Were you born in Montana? Were you born in the north of England, in the west of Ireland? Were you born in South Africa? You know, that would bring in a particular way that you would pay attention to the world, depending upon the sights and smells and the keenness of the wind. You know, if you were born in Yorkshire in the north of England, you'd be very aware of the wind growing up. And then you have your school systems and the teachers that meet you and help you out and or don't help you out. And so when you think about it, every individual life is this astonishing meeting place of all of these elements which will never meet again in quite the same way. And they've met in you, and they're continually moving to iterate themselves into the future. And so it's quite astonishing, really, to think of a human life as this evolving conversational presence which will never, ever occur again in space or time. And it's one of the reasons, you know, when you really think about it, really have an imagination about it, our great traditions have always seen an individual human life as being incredibly sacred because of that, and untouchable in its essence. And so it's this sense, you know, of absolute uniqueness, which is put into a communal conversation with others, that allows you to be courageous and generous. Because when you think about it, if you can really imaginatively give yourself the understanding of what it takes to bring you into this world and sustain you, then the fact, you know, that you have X amount of money in the bank or X multiplied by 2 amount of money in the bank is quite irrelevant, actually. The central conversation includes that amount of money in the bank, but it's just a very small proportion of this enormous meeting that's taking place in your life and in the future that you're about to enter.
Brilliant. Reminds me of the whole conversation about deep time. One of the things I'd like to talk about is the idea of poetry as part of the reimagining, as part of the stimulation of the imagination, in a way that really opens us up to this core conversation that we're talking about. Can you talk about that? Maybe, you know, some people think, oh, poetry, you know, I did that in the seventh grade, that was enough. So why is poetry important for exploring our own interiority and for expanding our own story of ourselves in relationship to the world, David?
Yes, well, first of all, if you say to yourself, well, I did poetry in seventh grade, then you didn't do poetry. You just had a bad teacher, that's all, you know, because right. Good poetry stays with you. You get a really catalytic understanding of the way in speech you can actually emancipate yourself into larger and larger imaginative territories, that you can overhear yourself saying things you didn't know you knew about the world, and that when you say them in a powerful enough way, there's no going back through the door that you've just walked through. And good poetry, you know, is language against which there are no defenses. And we've all been in a marital argument an argument where the other person actually says the truth. And when they say it, you say to yourself, you say, oh my God, that's true what they just said. And you may have to have a few minutes, you know, rear guard action where you pretend it's not true. But once it's said, you know, the couple are actually catapulted into the next phase of their relationship. Because once the truth is said, you cannot go back, actually. Or I should say, when the truth has been said and recognized at the same time. And so that's what you're attempting to do, you know, in poetry. I have a little piece I wrote, actually, about the effect I think poetry has on the body and the memory. It's called The Lightest Touch. Good poetry begins with the lightest touch. Good poetry begins with the lightest touch. A breeze arriving from nowhere. A whispered, healing arrival. A word in your ear. Good poetry begins with the lightest touch. A breeze arriving from nowhere. A whispered, healing arrival. A word in your ear. A settling into things. Then, like a hand in the dark, it arrests the whole body. Then, like a hand in the dark, it arrests the whole body, stealing you for revelation. In the silence that follows a great line, you can feel Lazarus deep inside, even the laziest, most deathly afraid part of you, lift up his hands and walk toward the light. In the silence that follows a great line, you can feel Lazarus, you can feel Lazarus, deep inside, even the laziest, most deathly afraid part of you, lift up his hands and walk toward the light. So what is that light? I think it's the light of a real conversation, to meet something other than yourself that's going to actually reveal yourself at the same time. And it's interesting, you know, I don't see myself as an overtly as an overt Christian, but I went to Sunday school long enough when I was a child. Many of those biblical stories are burned right into my consciousness as a way of understanding life, you know, and there was Lazarus waiting for me, you know, with the winding sheets falling off of him, walking out of the tomb. And in many ways, you know, that's an image of the way, as I said earlier, all of us have to bring ourselves back from the dead, or find ourselves in circumstances where healing powers can bring us back from the dead, you know, in each succeeding epoch of our lives. That almost every pattern in life eventually moves away from its early, beautiful, embryonic first showing in the world, you know, where everything was fresh and new, and actually turns into something that's actually smothering you and covering you over and making you invisible and makes you imprisoned by it. And you have to, in a sense, decompose under that blanket and reemerge in a different way on the other side. And as human beings, we're very good at the first half of the equation, which is when we're on the up and up, you know, and we're becoming bigger and our bank accounts are becoming bigger and our houses are worth more and we're writing or we're painting or we're successful at work. And we don't do as well, you know, in the sense of being present when things are naturally falling away from us in the latter half of the pattern. And but it's interesting to think that one half of reality is actually giving things away and letting things go. And that most human beings, when you think about it, are at war with reality half the time. They're constantly struggling to be this constantly efficient human being, but quite often efficient at things whose time has gone, you know, and that there's a creative undoing which is needed, where you let yourself alone and you start to have a deeper conversation with the tide that's actually going out, you know. The revelation has to do with disappearance. And there will be a reappearance, but not until you've gone through the due process of saying goodbye and lamenting and grieving. And then that curious spaciousness where the old has left and the new has not yet swum in on the next tide. And I think, you know, self-compassion in many ways has to do with simply coming to terms with the whole cyclical nature of reality. And if you can understand that half the time you're not meant to be on top of the world, you're not meant to know what's going on, you're not meant to have the language, you're meant to be paying attention. And you're meant to be finding out who's left when everything's been taken away. It's probably as good a definition of being Irish as any that I know.
You know, I was telling you earlier that I'd been at my yearly Bioneers conference the past weekend, and it's always not only a source of many of the people from that come on this show, but it's a source of great inspiration for me. And I was sitting listening to some of the speakers, and I found myself so constricted in my throat and so much wanting to just not only weep but scream at what you know, we were hearing about the state of the world, it was like contained. And one of the things that you talk about, David, is that relationship to vulnerability and the value of that. And I could see that there were places in my physical body that I was not willing to be vulnerable, or I had a hard time breaking through that place of holding it back. Can you speak to vulnerability and that issue in general?
Well, it's interesting to think that none of these conversations actually occur without some form of vulnerability. There's no real conversation in a relationship or marriage without real vulnerability. And things are never resolved by one person having all the answers. And in fact, you might fall in love with all knowingness and power at the beginning of the relationship. But after a good 6 to 9 months, it's the very thing that will kill what first brought you together, and that every relational conversation has to do with a mutual admitting of not being in full control. Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why a relationship is such a fierce kind of apprenticeship. And you, in a relationship, you get there by actually admitting, you know, what your sins or faults or difficulties are. And the other person, inspired by that, admits a few of their own. And then you get there together. And there's a beautiful kind of warm sweetness that comes with that. Now, it's interesting to think, you know, in the work world, that there's an equivalent form of vulnerability. But it's not in the same area. In the work world, and especially in leadership, if you're trying to run a business with people, or you're, you know, the head of a work group, or even you're just a member of a work group, then real vulnerability in the workplace usually has to do with not having all the answers all the time, especially if you're in a leadership position, and really inviting other people to help you out to get something done. And then it's interesting to ask yourself what the vulnerability is with the self. And in the book, The Three Marriages, the most difficult marriage to write about was the marriage with the self. You know, if you want a relationship, you know, if you're suddenly free, you can go and hang out in those wonderful single bars in downtown San Francisco, or you can put an advertisement on the internet. if you want a job, you can advertise, you can go on equivalent websites, you know, you can troll the papers. Where do you go if you want to meet the self? And that vulnerability, you know, the vulnerability that creates a conversation with the self has to do with actually not doing, with a kind of radical stopping. And it's one of the reasons our great contemplative traditions, you know, particularly the Zen tradition or the Catholic contemplative tradition, has such emphasis on following the breath and of paying attention from this still, silent place. And slowly, out of that really fierce, attentive not doing, this enormous sense of presence starts to come into your body, you know, into your relations with others, out of that silence. So it's interesting to think that vulnerability might not be a weakness, and that it actually might be an attentive faculty, that vulnerability might be a faculty for understanding where you are in the pattern, and how you can ask for all of this invisible help, which is ready to be offered to you.
I think a corollary of that is the whole issue of the broken heart, that wound in there that we often are trying to suppress or hide is one of our greatest sources, if not our greatest source of compassion in the world, but also being able to step into, at least I'm assuming that, interested in your thoughts, being able to step into that core conversation that is our conversation in the world.
Yes, I mean, if you think about it, there's no way of being in a relationship or marriage without having your heart broken. There's no way of being a good parent without having your heart broken by your son or your daughter. There's no way of running a business, actually, without having your heart broken again and again with the difficulties that you run into. And when you try to gain a little self-knowledge, there's no way you can actually face the disappointments about yourself without having your heart broken. So it's a great release, actually, to realize that there's no place you can put your feet, you know, which will absolve you from the vulnerabilities and heartbreak that have been the province of every human being since the beginning of time. And so how do you keep a kind of robust vulnerability, which is not expecting things to be going your way all of the time, and is big enough to hold the losses which are natural to each of these marriages in life. And there's a great line which I quoted on stage in the DVD in San Francisco, and I actually got it from my son, who was quoting it around his graduation this year. And it's a line of Camus, the great French philosopher and writer, and he said, "Live to the point of tears." And it's a lovely, actually a lovely discipline, actually, to follow, if you because it's not saying give yourself over to a maudlin sense of a maudlin disability. You know, it's actually calling for this robust form of vulnerability where you don't mind feeling to the quick the powerful poignancy of life. Yeah? And it was interesting to, you know, I just driving along with my daughter a few years ago in the car on the way to school, and she was there with all her friends in the back, and they were just so joyous and pointing at everything outside of the car window, and the cows in the fields and the horses and the hedges and the farms and the flowers. And and I just lost a close friend, you know, and I was thinking, how incredible, you know, those girls don't know there's death in the world. And it's something they'll have to learn, actually. But my being able to understand death actually enables me to understand the beautiful poignancy of being a young girl in the world, and how astonishing that is, and that they're not meant to know about death at that point. But as you grow older, you are meant to learn it. And somehow you have to be big enough for it. And you have to let it touch you. I have a good philosopher farmer friend in the west of Ireland, and whenever he sends his sheep off to market, you know, and they go into the trailer, he always says a bit of a prayer over them, you know, and he'll say a little Irish prayer or do a bit of the rosary or whatever. And he once turned to me and said, "It should always cost you something," he said, "when you send those sheep off." And I thought that was beautiful, actually. It should always cost you something. And a good marriage will always cost you something. A good relationship with your daughter or your son will cost you a lot, you know. And can you have a kind of Kazantzakis, Zorbian presence where you can still dance and sing and cry and
all at once
and reconcile, you know, double entry bookkeeping all at the same time.
Lovely. You know, I was watching the new hot off the press David White Live in San Francisco DVD, and one thing you said there was about alertness being the hidden discipline of familiarity. And then after that, you did the wonderful poem, "Everything is Waiting for You." Could you talk about that and maybe do the poem if it feels right?
Yes. Again, this is about attention as a way of creating this frontier identity where you stop seeing yourself as this piece of ammunition which you're just trying to aim in the right direction and fire at life, and you start to see yourself more of a meeting as a possibility of meeting something other than yourself, and so you're paying attention and trying to let things speak back to you in their own voice and not with some voice that you've placed upon them that you want them to say back to you, you know, that you want them to say certain things back to you, and you close off the revelation. So it's this fierce kind of attention. It's called Everything is Waiting for You. And it's written in the style of one of my favorite Irish poets, Derek Mahon. And it's my own poem, but I was consciously thinking of his style when I wrote it. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone, as if life were a progressive and cunning crime with no witness to the tiny hidden transgressions. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Surely, even you at times have felt the grand array, the swelling presence, and the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. Put down the weight of your aloneness. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything, everything, everything is waiting for you.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Your great mistake. That's me giving myself a good telling off in the mirror. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone. It is a great discipline to look at your life and see how much you feel as if you're doing it all yourself. And if you are, then that's a great indication, a great diagnostic feature that you're not in the conversation enough, you know. When you're in the conversation, you don't have to do the work. The conversation does the work. Yeah? So give yourself over to it and let that buoyancy actually carry you along. Practically, in my own life, you know, my own creative life, I often arrange for a group of people to will recognize a certain pattern in my work to bully me into taking the next step, you know. Whether it's writing a book or whether it's producing a DVD or someone says, hey, you know, I really like this. Can we do it? And I always say no to begin with. And then enough people are a person is sincere enough, they come back, and then you get into the conversation. And if you follow it sincerely enough, at the end of the conversation, you have a DVD or you have a book. And it's the meeting that does all the work. Sometimes it's the meeting with the page, you know, alone in your writing room. And other times it's a meeting on a phone with a group of people. But there's all of this incredible help in the world. And we limit our genius, you could say, when we put a wall around ourselves and refuse to have the conversations that keep those three marriages alive, the marriage with another, with your work, and with yourself.
Hmm. I think it's a great mistake to think that we are in a conversation that we are alone, when we are in fact in a conversation that we are a community. And there's so much that we miss in the conversation of our community by being in our aloneness and believing that it doesn't matter. And as the days and years go by with the changes in the world, I think it's really important that people begin to recognize and continue to support the things in their community that feed them and nourish them. And one of those things is community radio. And David, you and I were talking earlier about the idea of radio and how it triggers the imagination. Can you just talk about that for just a minute also for our listeners?
Well, I do think, you know, in evolutionary terms, we're slaves to our eyes. And you had to be looking all the time, you know, to see what was coming out of the bush. And I've been in Africa quite a bit over the last few years, and I really understand that physical necessity, you know. But because of that, you know, if you're watching television, you're constantly being drawn to things which ultimately you have no interest in. But because it's moving and because it's colorful, you can't help but look at it. It's like, it's one of the terrible things about televisions in bars in the United States. You know, they draw all the conversation out of the room because everyone's eyes are actually being drawn towards it and away from a more pub-like atmosphere that you can get when you've just got the people you're with. And one of the things that I think is beautiful about radio is that you've got this this kind of massive intimacy, or this oral intimacy, where you're listening in a deep kind of way, even if you're driving along. And you can be driving in the city, or you can be driving in the High Sierra, by a riverside, you know, or by a gas station, and you're in part of a much larger conversation. If I'm looking at an item of news on the internet, I, you know, the physical understanding is that I'm looking at it by myself, unless I actually suddenly see, oh yes, other people have commented on this article also. But there's something about radio in which we all can feel each other listening at the same time, whether we're in our kitchens or our cars. And so I'm a great fan of the whole medium. And I do think, you know, that I'd much prefer a radio interview than a television interview, where the length of time you get is so short because of the visual impatience of the old eyes. And so the ears have it, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, David, thank you for your tireless work, for your commitment to opening people's minds and hearts. And all these years we've known each other now, it's just always a joy to spend time with you and have you on the show. So
likewise, yeah. Thank you. Great pleasure. Good conversation.
Yeah, we'll talk to you. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5, Nevada City, and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rwelistening.net.